You are listening
events.
To 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
March, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done, and by union what we will can be accomplished still, drops of water turn a mill, singly done,
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. A weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Plasterers and Cement Masons Local 518 and United Auto Workers Local 249. We here at Plasterers and Cement Masons Local 518 want to thank all the hardworking union members in Kansas City, and we want you to remember Local 518 for all your construction needs. And United Auto Workers Local 249 members building the best Ford trucks and vans in the world. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, will Santa be late for Christmas? Will his supply chain deficiencies leave your stocking empty? Some people want to blame workers who don't want to work or a global pandemic. On this week's or on tonight's Heartland Labor Forum, we'll explore the truth about supply chain blues. Then, we'll ask American Postal Workers Union President Mark Dimenstein if postal cutbacks are slowing Santa down and about needed legislation and hopes for expansion of the Postal Service. In the news, pro-worker ordinances passed in both KCMO and KCK, and Starbucks workers' win in Buffalo is inspiring other baristas to organize. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Michael Amish. And now for the news.
This is the news from our side for December 16, 2021. Last week, the Kansas City, Missouri City Council passed an ordinance guaranteeing the tenant's right to counsel and becoming the first city in the Midwest to establish a universal policy without income restrictions. Over 100 tenants and low-wage workers, many of whom spent months drafting the policy alongside Councilwoman Andrea Bao, attended the council meeting to witness the victory. The vote makes Kansas City the 13th city in the country to pass tenants' right to counsel. KC Tenants is not only a model of how to build grassroots power that succeeds in winning big changes from a city, but they also have developed a unique participatory model. For example, the Tenants' Right to Counsel Ordinance was developed by leaders with KC Tenants and allies in the Missouri Workers' Center, Stand Up KC, in partnership with lawyers at Heartland Center for Jobs and Freedom. The ordinance was co-sponsored by Councilwoman Melissa Robinson, Councilman Kevin O'Neill, Councilman Eric Bunch, and Councilwoman Catherine Shields. Tenants' right to counsel is the guaranteed right to legal representation in landlord-tenant cases. The ordinance assigns the city manager to identify full funding for the program, with full implementation to begin in June 2022. Gina Kiala, a lawyer for the Heartland Center, said, "Having a lawyer means the difference between staying housed or being on the streets. And every time we turn someone down, we know things won't end well for them. It's hard to sleep at night. This should not be happening. Everyone who is sued should have an attorney.
PAI reports that President Biden is publicly and bluntly backing the 1,400 Kellogg's workers on strike over 2 months since October 5th. Biden said, "Every employee has the right to collectively bargain. Full stop. I am deeply troubled by reports of Kellogg's plans to permanently replace striking workers. Permanently replacing striking workers is an existential attack on the union and its members' jobs and livelihoods. I strongly support legislation that would ban that practice." Biden's tweeted statement of December 10th came as the forced strike continued since the workers, members of the bakery, confectionery, and tobacco workers and grain millers, overwhelmingly rejected the profitable firm's proposed contract. Kellogg's now won't bargain. While BCTGM gave no official reason for that turndown, news reports indicated that the company refused to budge on workers' demands that it eliminate its two-tier wage and pension system or its mandated extensive overtime, including weekends and holidays. A ban on company replacement of economic strikers, replacement that the U.S. Supreme Court legalized in the late 1930s, is also part of the Protect the Right to Organize Act, or the PRO Act, labor's number one legislative priority. Biden strongly supports the PRO Act, too. The BCTGM president, Anthony Shelton, welcomed Biden's backing, which contrasts with Barack Obama's White House silence more than 4 years ago when Mondelez moved its Oreo cookie production line from Chicago's South Side to Monterrey, Mexico, taking hundreds of jobs. The union asked Obama, a Chicagoan and then Biden's boss, to speak out. He didn't. Shelton said, "We wholeheartedly agree with President Biden that Kellogg's threats to permanently replace striking workers is an existential attack on the union."
In other pro-worker action, the Kansas City, Missouri City Council has passed a wage theft ordinance, which not only criminalizes violators, but also applies to contractors who do work for the city. We'll have more on this in January. Then across the state line in Kansas City, Kansas, the unified government, according to the Labor Beacon, passed responsible bidding language, which will require contractors who bid on government work to certify and submit evidence that all of their workers have passed a 10-hour OSHA course, indicating that they know the basics of working safety. Contractors and subcontractors must also have drug and alcohol abuse prevention policy. Gradually across the country, public entities are requiring responsible bidder standards and moving away from accepting bids from the lowest bidder. Lowest bidder requirements often create a race to the bottom in working conditions for construction workers. Just this week, the unified government inaugurated a new mayor, Tyrone Gardner, and new commissioners. Gardner, a former assistant police chief, who was endorsed by most of KCK unions and the Tri-County AFL-CIO, except the Fraternal Order of Police. He is the first black mayor in Kansas City, Kansas, and his election has been touted as a sea change in KCK politics. Gardner has pledged to maintain close contact with all residents and has appointed liaisons to key constituencies, including education, Latinx residents, and labor.
And finally, energized by the unionization vote win in Buffalo, New York, workers at two Starbucks cafes in Boston filed on December 13th for union representation elections. And even as the Buffalo ballots were mailed in November, Starbucks workers in Mesa, Arizona filed too. Workers United, the service employees sector that won recognition in Buffalo, filed all three union recognition election petitions, the National Labor Relations Board reported. But in Boston, the NLRB records show another SEIU branch, the International Association of Paramedics and EMTs, may be competing for workers' votes. The victorious Buffalo workers, who won at one Starbucks there and are leading at a second pending the count of challenged ballots, let the cat out of the bag in a tweet which said, quote, "A message from our Boston partners who just filed for two union elections today. We are proud to stand in solidarity with our partners in Buffalo and throughout Boston who have inspired us in the fight for equal bargaining power and a democratic workplace. Buffalo's Starbucks Workers United tweeted. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Stephen Hill, Jen Zaman, Michael Savoir, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Trying to make a living, I can't save a cent. It takes all of my money just to eat and pay my rent. I got the blues. Got those inflation blues.
Good evening and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm your host for the first half of the show, Michael Savoir. I'm a retired Teamster and a very active labor reformer. Our show tonight is entitled Supply Chain Blues. Our musical prelude was by the legendary B.B. King, and it's called Inflation Blues. My guest tonight is Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a visiting professor at the New School University in New York City. His groundbreaking book, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, inspired the creation of the nonprofit organization, Democracy at Work. Welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum, Richard. How are you?
Pretty well, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Indeed, Richard. You know, corporate America has finally admitted that there is a supply chain crisis, something that many of us have known for years. I'm just not so sure they've been honest with themselves about the reasons why. Some have blamed it on the container ship that's stuck in the Suez Canal. Others have blamed it on truck drivers and warehousemen. Still others find a global pandemic the cause for our woes. What say you, Richard Wolff?
Well, on the assumption that you want the truth and you don't want more or less BS, I'm going to try to tell it to you as best I can. When corporations are doing things that appear to the public to be useful, they take all the credit they can. But when they're doing things that are against the interests of the public and that the public doesn't like, they become specialists in blaming anybody other than themselves. Let me start with the inflation we're facing now and then go to the supply issues because it's really the same story. An inflation is when prices go up in general. Not every price the same amount. Some prices don't go up at all, but the general level of prices rises. That's all that the word inflation ever meant. Okay, to understand an inflation, you have to understand who sets prices. Who decides that that shirt is going to cost $30 versus $20, or that that software program is going to cost $350 rather than $25, and so on. Well, as any working man or woman knows, if you're an employee, your job description has never included setting the prices of what you help to sell. You work, you produce the output, but determining the price at which it is sold, that's the right, the prerogative, the freedom of the employers. So let's be really clear. A tiny minority of the American people are employers, 1%, maybe 2%. That's it. They're the ones who set prices. So if there's an inflation, It isn't the mass of us, because our job is to pay the price. It's a tiny, unelected minority that's in the position to set prices. So the first person you ought to direct your upset to, if rising prices are pinching your standard of living, is to the employer class, because they're the ones raising the price. All right, now step two, and there's only two steps. Here comes step two. Why do the employers raise the prices? Well, the only honest answer to that is the same as answering the question, why do employers do anything that they do? Why do they buy machines? Why do they expand overseas? Why do they change their technology? Why do they redesign the package that they put their product in? And the answer is always the same. The name of the game in American capitalism is to make a profit. If you go to business school and you get an MBA for having been through the curriculum of business, you will know that the basic message you were given is expressed in phrases like, profit is our bottom line, or profit is why we are in business, or profit is the goal of what we do. They're right. That's correct. But that answers our question. Prices go up if and when it's profitable to employers to do that, like everything else they do. They are either doing it to raise their profits or they're doing it to protect their profits. All right, here's then the problem for the employer. The only way the employers survive is if we, the employers, buy whatever it is they're selling. We got to go out and buy the very products we help make. But we're not going to be happy buyers if we face rising prices and the employer has been honest enough to say, I'm charging you more because I want to be richer. And if it makes you poorer, tough. That's the way the system works. They don't say that because it's the truth. They're afraid. They're afraid that the people who face rising prices will be angry at the employers for making extra profits by jacking up the price. Mm-hmm. And they're right. Mm-hmm. So they don't do it. And here's what they do instead. They blame others. Here we go. I'm just giving you a smattering. Number one, it's the workers, you see. We have to pay them higher wages. And so, of course, we're raising prices. In other words, don't be angry at us. Be angry at those workers because they're the real reason you're facing higher prices. Or the oil companies have jacked up the price of energy, and so we have to pay. There's always somebody else, some scapegoat, some blameworthy character they will point the finger at. But the truth of it is, if you want to know why prices are going up, the true ultimate answer is because it's profitable for the employers to do it.
Mm-hmm. Richard, you know, I'm reminded of the immortal words of Malcolm X. Malcolm says that the chickens have come home to roost. Does this not explain quite concisely what's happening with our American economy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, for 100 years, the American economy grew and expanded, and all the business community wanted us to celebrate them as if they were the cause of it. They were responsible. Entrepreneurship, captains of industry, we've heard it all. But now that the economic system of the United States is heading down, nobody is responsible. We're not supposed to blame the capitalist. He was only supposed to get the credit on the ride up, not on the ride down. But hey, the capitalists are just as much in charge today as they were 20, 40, 60, 80 years ago. They just don't want to be blamed for what's happening. And now let me do the supply chain, because it's the same story. Over the last 2 years, the American economy has suffered one of the great problems in the history of the country. You know, we've had economic crashes before, and the worst one was still the 1930s. And we've had public health disasters before. Back in 1918, we had what we called then the Spanish flu, and it killed 700,000 Americans, just a little bit less than have been killed by COVID now. But what we've never had before is both an economic crash and the public health disaster at the same time. Now, that means a system that is already peaked and heading down has two enormous problems on its hands. And let me be real honest with you and your audience. Our performance with these two problems has been, and I'm being really nice now, subpar, lousy. Let me give you an example. We are one of the richest countries in the world. We have one of the most developed medical systems in the world. And yet, we are coming up on 800,000 people who've died of COVID. And I won't even talk about the millions that have had the disease and may have medical issues going forward for God knows how long. But I want to compare it to a country nowhere near as rich as ours, the People's Republic of China, a country that has four times the population we do. There are four Chinese citizens for every American citizen in this country. How many people died of COVID in that country, which is where the disease, if I understand correctly, began? The answer, World Health Organization statistics, 8,000. Let me repeat that. A country four times larger than ours has had 8,000 deaths from COVID. We, a country only the quarter of the size of China, have had 800,000 deaths. You know what? That's called a colossal failure. Mm-hmm. And it's not about this hospital or that mandate or masks or ventilators. This is about a system that could not get itself together to deal with a crisis. And it isn't getting itself together to deal with any other crisis either. All right, in this country, corporations over the last 2 years have had, not all of them, but most of them, problems. They haven't been able to sell their product the way they used to. They haven't been able to make the product the way they used to. And their profits suffered over the last couple of years, in most cases, not all, but most. So what are they doing? They are reacting the way businessmen and women always react. They are taking a whole host of steps to reduce the profit losses they face, to make up in new ways the profit they didn't earn. So let me give you some examples. Before, they would prepare for a rainy day by buying more inputs than they need and storing them in a corner of the warehouse so that if an unforeseen increase in demand happened, they would have a stockpile to draw on to meet it. Well, they are pinched for money these days, so they didn't do that. And then when some demand increase happened, they had to tell the people who wanted to buy it, sorry, we don't have it. We can't send it to you. And here came a moment of truth. They could have said, if they were honest, We have a problem because we took steps to protect our profits that mean we can't meet your demand at this time. We took care of us at your expense. No, no, no. We have to invent whole new mysteries. The supply chain disruption. What? Why are you making a wild abstraction out of something very straightforward and very easy? Let me give you another example. Inflation. Inflations and supply side problems almost always go together in history. And one leads to the other, back and forth, asking which one came first is right up there with that chicken and egg problem. And we know better than to worry about that one, right? So here's an example. Here's an example. I know I'm a businessman. Let's say I make shoes. So I've got to buy leather. I'm looking at an inflation. I'm noticing the price of leather is going up 5% over the last month, 6%. So I'm saying to myself, oh, in order to protect my profits, what I've got to do is buy a lot more leather now before the prices go up. And then I'll have that leather to work up into shoes for the rest of the year. So suddenly, our shoemaking capitalist orders 5 times the normal amount of leather from his supplier. And the supplier, eager for business, sends him all of that leather. Okay, but a week later, somebody else wants to buy leather. He doesn't have any more. And he says to the guy, I'm sorry, I don't have any leather to send you. Well, why not? Okay, here comes the moment of truth. Well, because one of my other buyers is worried about the inflation, is protecting his profits against the inflation, and he bought me out. He bought all the leather I have. So I'm happy because I sold all my leather. I made my money, and he's happy because he's got leather cheaper than he would have had to pay. But you, dear buyer, you're screwed. Me and the leather guy that I sent to, we made extra. You lose. Screw you. But we're not going to get that honesty. Instead, we're going to be told there are supply chain problems. There are ships backed up in the Los Angeles harbor, or there was that big ship in the Suez Canal. Stop. That's not the reason. It's because we have a system in which everybody is trying to make profit off of everybody else. It's not pretty. It's ugly. And every now and then, that ugliness slaps you right in the face. And that's the truth of what is happening now with inflations and supply chains.
For sure.
Listen, before we close, I want to talk a little bit about your work at Democracy at Work. It's been celebrated nationwide. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about it in our last minute?
Absolutely. It follows from everything we've just said. For me, setting up an economic system in which the factories, the offices, the stores are all organized with a tiny group of people at the top, the owner, the board of directors, if it's a corporation, and then the vast majority of us give up our democratic rights the minute we walk into the workplace. They tell us where to go, where to sit, what to do, how to do it, when to do it, how long you can be in the bathroom. And then they send us home for pizza and beer and come back the next day and do it all again. Yes. This is an undemocratic and in the end, cruel way of organizing. I don't believe in it. I think many of our problems, like the inflation, like the supply chain that we've just talked about, come from this arrangement. I think the solution is to change the system. And I'm not afraid to say so. I don't observe the taboo that has existed for so long in America about saying we can do better than capitalism. And what I mean by that is we can run the business ourselves.
Well, Richard, we're closing, so I would like to certainly thank you for finding time to share with our listeners on the Heartland Labor Forum. And as always, man, we appreciate your insight. We appreciate your work.
And I, in turn, appreciate your having the courage to have programs which talk about these issues without the silly taboos that have held us back for too long.
This is Jeremy Rothkuchel, co-host and producer of Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls. Listen in this Friday morning at 9:30 a.m. when I speak with cultural historian and author Walter Hickson about his recently published books, Architects of Repression, How Israel and Its Lobby Put Racism, Violence, and Injustice at the Center of U.S. Middle East Policy, and Imperialism and War, The History Americans Need to Own. Once again, that's Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls this Friday at 9:30 a.m.
Hi, everyone. This here is an update on the Amp Up for the Future campaign. We have topped 105,000 so far, and thank you very much to everyone who's pitched in. We still have over 89,000 in matching commitments from a group of wonderful KKFI supporters. Whether it's a one-time gift or a commitment over a couple years, please consider an extra gift above your normal generosity. Or, of course, make your first gift right now, and it will be matched dollar for dollar. To double your gift to KKFI right now, go to kkfi.org/ampup or call 888-931-0901. Again, that's kkfi.org/ampup or call 888-931-0901. Thank you so much for listening.
This is Judy Ansel. Mark Demenstein is the president of the American Postal Workers Union, APWU, which represents more than 200,000 employees in the U.S. Postal Service and approximately 1,500 employees in the private sector mailing industry. He's been the APWU president since 2013, and before that was the national lead field organizer, pioneering the organizing of postal-related jobs that had been privatized. And before working for the national union, he was president of the Greater Greensboro, North Carolina area local for 12 years, where he also organized the Greensboro chapter of Jobs with Justice, something close to my heart. We welcome you, Mark, and thanks so much for being on.
Judy, thanks so much for having me. It's indeed a pleasure, and greetings to all of your listeners. And if any postal workers and APW members are out there, a big hello.
Well, we've got a bunch of them here, so good. Great. So we're going to start with the main theme of our show, which is, will Aunt Susie in California's Christmas gift for the kids that she mailed yesterday get here in time? And in other words, aside from all the supply chain delays that we've been hearing about, what about the U.S. Postal Service? Have the cutbacks affected the mail?
Well, Judy, look, let me start by simply saying that it's in the DNA of every postal worker to get your presents, your packages, your medicines, your correspondence there to your front door, to your apartment, to wherever you live, quickly and on time. So, and that dedication has shown through in this terrible pandemic, where despite the challenges and the dangers, postal workers were out there as frontline essential heroes like so many other workers were. We think the holiday season is actually going well. And so we certainly hope the answer to your question is, yep, that package is going to be there on time. Last year, there was a huge problem. And every person in this country is a postal customer, and we all know that the mail was not right. Now, there were many factors we probably don't have the time to get into and all, but part of it was the pandemic. Part of it was chronic understaffing in the post office for decades. But what the pandemic did also is it created a huge surge of e-commerce packages, something that the post office was not ready for. So we certainly, as the union and postal workers, want to do everything that we can. We're not running the post office, but we want to do everything we can to make sure that this season is different. And I'll give postal management credit in this area. They actually have staffed up better, not only at the holiday season, but throughout the year. They actually added jobs for the first time in many, many years. And they added space that they needed. One of the things that led to the debacle last year was the post office had closed, and many of the listeners have probably heard about it. They closed a lot of processing plants from 2010, 11, and 12. And then lo and behold, as there's package growth, there wasn't any room to put the packages. So we certainly are having a better season than last year, and we're always proud and pleased and dedicated to bring good cheer this time of the year.
Well, that's good. I've noticed that the lines at the post office are shorter than they were last year. So that must be because of the increased staffing. But how have the cutbacks affected your members in particular in terms of their jobs and their working conditions?
Well, over 15 or 20 years now, our union has shrunk to half the size that we had been. Wow. Some of that's automation. Mm-hmm. Some of it's changing mail habits. Some of it's piecemeal privatization. The whole question of privatization, turning public, the public commons, the public good, the public money over to the private sector to make private profit. There are two ways to get at that. One is sell it all and it's pure privatization. The other is to piecemeal it. And the postal system has been piecemealed over the years. So, for instance, much of the work that the people that we represent do, sorting and things like that, have been pushed into the private sector. And they do a lot of sorting. They make money. They get corporate discounts on their mailing that we as individuals don't get. And then they laugh all the way to the bank, so to speak. And then they bypass an awful lot of the postal operations that used to be done by unionized postal workers accountable to the people of the country. So the cutbacks there, and then there are changes in the mail. There's no getting around it. People mail less first-class letters. Many people pay their bills online. But that's not all bad. We have a saying in our union, the internet taketh and the internet giveth, because people also order online, packages are generated, and the post office is there to go to everybody's address, 161 million addresses, 6 days a week, sometimes seven. And that's part of the beauty of the public institution, universal service. So, you know, yes, to answer your basic question, the cutbacks have affected the number of jobs. And when we're also short-staffed, the stress and strain on the workers is far greater, and the stress and strain on the customers. Because if we're not staffed right, the customers don't get the service that they deserve. All around, rather than cutbacks, we want to see the post office grow, do new things, creative things, more financial services. And we're against this cut and slashing and moaning about the changes in mail. Let's go out and do new things, important things, and continue to carry out our public mission of binding the country together.
Well, sounds like you have a vision for the post office. But before I ask you about that, you just finished your contract negotiations, and I know you're having a series of meetings today with your members to explain what's in it. What are you proud of? What did you accomplish in this new contract?
Well, negotiations are never easy, because whatever union we're in, whoever is negotiating with whatever company, public or private, we're not negotiating with ourselves. We have an opposition. We have very different goals as a union and management. But we are very proud of reaching a tentative agreement that will go out to a vote of all our members sometime in January. We're extremely proud that we have annual pay raises, which is important, but we also have full cost of living allowance. And at a time of inflation, that underscores how important that is for all workers to have, and very few workers do. So we have full COLA. So we have a solid wage package when you add in the annual wage increase plus COLA. We also have a dilemma that many other unionized workers face, which we have multi-tiered systems. We don't have time to get into the history of that. It was before my time. We've done what we can since we assumed office to try to bridge those gaps between the tiers. But we have now a whole non-career workforce that we were able to get in this contract. And we're very, very proud of this. An automatic mechanism to career, at least after 2 years. It may happen before that. There are other vehicles that may make it happen before that.
Explain the difference between career and non-career.
So the basically it's pay, benefits, job security. So the career employees have the full benefit from vacation leave to sick leave to health insurance to retirement. The non-career workers, for example, are paid much less, do not get, for example, the COLA that the career workers get. don't get retirement benefits. So the conversion to career is a life-changing event for any postal workers. And the basically the only way in now is through the non-career side. So before, we've had people working in the non-career side 5, 6, 7, 8 years. Now there's going to be a backstop where if you come into the post office, outside of the very, very small post offices, so it's just about all of the non-career workforce, you know that at the two-year mark, you will have a career job, retirement benefits, all the protections, and the full load of postal benefits that have been won through the union. So that's when you add that to the wage increases, the calls, and we also took some other steps to continue to try to bridge the two tiers in our career workforce. We have two tiers there, plus the non-career tier. We also have some amazing benefits, Judy, that sometimes in negotiations, it's not just what you get, but what you kept. We have no layoff protection after 6 years of employment as career workers. We have a 50-mile limit on what we call excess. Since they can't lay workers off, sometimes they can move workers. It's called excessing from one place to another. We have maintained a 50-mile limit, so people's lives are not disrupted, where they can get moved 200 or 300 miles, and schools and spouses work and the like. So there have been many gains in terms of what we kept, and there are many gains in terms of moving forward. So we're proud. And look, it's the way it should be. It's going to now be in the hands of the members to decide and vote on a ratification process. And every union should belong to the members. And so we look forward to that part of the process.
We're talking to Mark Dimenstein, president of the American Postal Workers Union. Well, it sounds like you're very much in sync with what's going on with the rest of the labor movement, too, in terms of its attempt to get rid of the super divisive two-tier, right, three-tier systems. And, you know, we're still seeing, of course, strikes over that going on right now. What kind of postal service do we really need in this country? I mean, we have UPS, we have FedEx, we have these package delivery places, but I've noticed that I get UPS or FedEx packages delivered by my letter carrier. So there's some kind of interchange there that's going on. Is that the future, that more and more you're going to be helping these private companies, or should the future be different?
Well, I think the future should be very different. It's interesting when we talk about these private companies, and, you know, we're certainly pleased that UPS is a unionized company. There are brothers and sisters out there working in the same industry. But the reality is that the post office belongs to the people of the country. It's not a business. It's not about shareholders, not about Wall Street, not about high-paid CEOs. And so what that gives us is that universal service mandate, no matter who we are, it's really a democratic, small d, democratic right of the people of the country. No matter who we are, no matter where we live, whether in the most concentrated urban centers, the most rural outposts, and everywhere in between, we have an equal right at uniform and reasonable rates to this service that binds us together. Now, everybody uses it differently, but the difference with us and the UPSs and the FedExes is they go where they can make money. It's all about profit. So if we didn't have the public anchor in this industry, then whether people get services and at what cost people get services will depend on the bottom dollar rather than the public commons and the public good that the post office is part of. So while we see things changing, and they've always changed, I have said to people that say, well, the internet's going to destroy the post office. I said, well, you could have said that when phones came in, because people started communicating differently. Yes, we all communicate, or many of us do, most of us do probably now, through email. But it doesn't mean we don't need our medicines through the mail. 80 to 90% of our veterans who have VA benefits get their medicines through the mail. It doesn't mean we don't want those personal cards going from grandparents to grandkids and the other way, our financial transactions. The importance of the post office to small business and to link local small businesses with local customers. And we just think there's so much more that the post office can do under its mission We once had a savings bank, almost 60 years in this country, many posts around the world people can bank at. Why not do things like that? We have this predatory payday lending, check cashing industry that's preying on the low-income workers. The post office can be that public answer to that social problem where people are spending almost $2,500 a year who get locked into this stuff because they don't have access to a bank and other financial services.
So you think the post office should be a lender?
Well, I think that there are steps between where we are now and getting back to a savings bank. That would actually take legislative action. Yes, we are for that. But along the way, why can't the post office do paycheck cashing without ripping people off, putting, you know, a small cost, putting it on a no-fee debit card? Why can't there be ATMs in post office? Why can't people do more financial transactions from one post office to the other? Why can't we put electric charging stations in front of post offices all over the country to help the transition that's so needed from fossil fuels?
Wait a second. If they put an ATM in my post office, which is closed except for like 3 hours a day only on weekdays, that's not going to be very helpful. So then they have to open the post offices.
Yes,
right?
Yes. And we actually think that the more services that are provided, then the more communities will demand and can demand that their post offices be open when people need them. We've always opposed the reduction in retail hours. And it sounds like you may live in a smaller community.
I live in an urban community that had its own post office, which they tried to sell 10, 15 years ago, and the people opposed it. And so then they cut back the hours.
Well, we absolutely, absolutely oppose that whole direction. We think that the hours should be expanded. The post office should be open later so working people coming off work can have full access. And when they shrink hours like that, when postal management shrinks hours like that, it feeds privatization because then people have to go elsewhere to get their business taken care of. And also, Judy, when we talk about new things, we're in this e-commerce world. You know, who the heck, you know, I'm a little older. People can't see me, but they can hear me. I never dreamed of shopping online. We used to go to stores and walk out with shopping bags. But 30% of e-commerce is returned. Wouldn't the post office be the easiest place to do that kind of work where you could return something, get money back in your account right away through all this electronic advances and codes and all of that? Bring it to the post office, get your money back, and the post office sends it back to the original provider. So there are just many, many opportunities and many, many great things that we can do. But you're right. The post office has to be open in order to provide those services.
Yeah. There's a bill in Congress right now that a Postal Reform Act that you are working very hard to get passed. Do you want to tell us about it?
In 2006, there was a terrible law passed called the Postal Accountability Enhancement Act. And it did a few things, but the worst it did is it objectively defunded the public postal service. If you want to privatize any public entity, you have to start with trying to starve it. And then once you starve it, you say, it's not working. The private sector can do it better. This is what they've done a lot with public education. They've starved it. And so what the PAEA did is it forced the post office to pre-fund retiree health benefits, not retirement benefits, health benefits, 75 years into the future, and funded it 100%, build it up within 10 years. It drained $5.5 billion out of the postal treasury every year. It became this cycle that the post office is bleeding money on paper. And then that became the idea that we have to close facilities, we have to reduce hours in post offices, we have to slow down the mail. By the way, that burden, nobody else, public or private, ever has to do. The post office was paying that benefit as they went. This new bill, if it passes and it's got strong bipartisan support, which is very important to get it done, it won't get done without bipartisan support. The essence of this bill, there are a number of factors in it, but the main thing it would do is it would eliminate that pre-funding mandate that's strangling the financial condition of the Postal Service. It won't fix it all, but it'll be a huge step forward. There are also some other good things in the bill. For instance, it would encourage 6-day delivery.
Okay, and that bill is, I just looked it up. The Postal Reform Act is House Bill 3076. Is it in the Senate too?
Yes, there's a companion bill in the Senate. And when I talk about the real strong bipartisan support, it's there. And we want to maintain it. We would love this bill to have passed 4 months ago. It should have. We don't know if we can get it done this next week if the House comes back, but likely it will be when they return in mid-January. So we're excited about that. People can call their congresspeople at the right time if they wish and say 3076 is a good bill for the people of the country. Please support it.
So I guess it would be important for people to write their senators as well as congresspeople.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's great. And we are out of time. I want to thank you very much, Mark Dimenstein, for being on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Judy, thanks so much for inviting me. Listen, this is a great time for labor. Workers are stepping up, stepping out. We deserve better. We deserve more. We're learning lessons of the pandemic. And I, for one, am out there in solidarity with every worker on the picket line, every worker, and our members are fighting for good contracts, fighting for more unions. So good to see you, Judy. Carry on all the good work out there. And again, greetings to all of your listeners.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Take care.
And Dimenstein told me after I stopped recording that one of the reasons he thought that the Postal Administration was willing to eliminate much of the two-tier system was that they had finally realized that people with no career opportunities at the post office were leaving. He said, there are postal routes so short-staffed that people are only getting their mail 3 times a week. So the Great Resignation has hit the post office and actually affected the contract negotiations to improve conditions for the workers. He also said that Kansas Senator Jerry Moran and Missouri Senator Roy Blunt are both potential votes for this postal reform bill, and people need to contact them. I'd like to give a shout out to all of the people in the supply chain, whether you're a truck driver, you work on the railroad, or you're a postal worker. We want to say thank you for your work.
And now this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for this week. Sunday, December 19th at 10 a.m., it's the UU Forum with Leonard Zeskind on How Can the White Supremacist Be Stopped? This one's going to be on Zoom, so go to allsoulskc.org for the link. The AFL-CIO Organizing Institute will be holding 2-hour training January 12th on Building a Campaign to Win. A second 3-day afternoon, more and more comprehensive class will be taught on January 25th through the 27th. Registration opens December 13th at 11 a.m. and will close when classes are full. These classes are free to unions, so go to www.aflcio.org/OI to sign up. This Saturday, December 18th at 9 a.m., is the third Saturday Wyandotte County Democratic Breakfast. This one is going to be on Zoom. Go to Wyandotte County Democratic Breakfast for a link. And Lead Missouri Action, which is affiliated with the Missouri AFL-CIO, is holding candidate trainings for local elections in January. This is going to be online from January 18th to the 20th at 6 p.m. or in person January 29th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. in Kansas City. To register, go to leadmoaction.org and click on Candidates. And that is it for tonight's show. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, will Chilean labor finally undo their fascist constitution? And we'll also discuss the UAW referendum. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. I have been your engineer and half host, Jen Zaman.
But I was too young to see. Now I'm get our prize, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
We are the working class, and that's the place to be.